I'm going to plug this quite heavily on my show tomorrow because it's very local to me.
What time is your show, Billy?
Oh, between 10 a.m. and midday. Thank you for mentioning that, Tony. There are free writing workshops in Westbury-on-Trim starting on Tuesday, the 26th of January at the Westbury-on-Trim Church of England Primary School. And it is part of the Trading Local initiative, which premiered in Bedminster, I think, round about April, May time, with Show of Strength Theatre Company. It's a very interesting community initiative, getting local people to write locally sourced monologues, which are then performed by the professionals of Show of Strength Theatre Company in shops, so that the local people can go along. And basically, it's an initiative to try and get people through the doors of the shops on their doorstep, as opposed to doing all the shopping in the supermarket.
And is the idea of keeping it local, is this one of your themes that runs through a lot of your... work you do on
After a fashion. I mean, our broadcast area is obviously through the medium of the internet. We are available worldwide, but you know, the immediate broadcast remit of BCFM is pretty local, and I agree with that, because since the demise of Summerfield, there isn't any major supermarket chains have their base even in the West Country, I don't think. So I think it's important to continually invest in the people on your doorstep and the contributors to the harmonious life that we all lead in the city.
On that theme, I wonder if you've been through the letters page in today's Evening Post.
No, I haven't.
Because
I can see you're looking at
I'm waving it around the studio now. You'll see that it's on page 11, which is the letters page in the Evening Post this evening. Time for some new ideas at Radio Anywhere. And the criticism here is that Radio Bristol could be, this is the BBC Radio Bristol, could be a station which someone could pick up anywhere. One of the emailers into the Evening Post, Dave Marks, has got quite a sort of diatribe, and there are several other letters here also making sort of complaints really about the changes that have been on Radio Bristol. Where we once had Roger Bennett, followed by Nigel Dando, Rachel Burden, who's now at Five Live, and Ben Prater, we then had the bumbling Richard Wyatt with the most pedestrian breakfast show ever. And now we have Steve Lefevre's chaotic effort, which is little more than less than hilarious banter between him and his near hysterical female assistants. Well, what they're saying essentially here is that there's not all that much really local about Bristol, and also that there aren't all that many local accents. And the criticism is really aimed at Tim Pemberton, who's the managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, since he took over, I think it was about 2 years ago, from Jenny Lacey. I wonder, are you both avid Radio Bristol listeners, Martin and Billy?
Personally, I do tune in occasionally, purely because, as far as I can see, they're the competition, so I need to monitor what their output is like. And I have to say, for the sort of work that I do on the Saturday show, between 10 a.m. and midday, it's now called the Bristol Arts Show, folks, so tune in. I have to say, I don't think they cover the arts within the city particularly well. I know it's a difficult and a broad brief, but they could, certainly in terms of the sport output, I think they have five or six sport commentators, and there's a whole sports department up there, and there isn't anybody at all for arts and culture, I don't think, that I can see.
Well, one of the problems, I think, I mean, I've worked in BBC local radio myself, and one of the problems is that you get a lot of information which is shoved under your nose, as the producers do anyway, comes in on email nowadays, but in those days there were record promoters and all sorts of things would be in the production office saying, what about this, what about this? And so for you to actually get proactive as a producer and go out and find material for yourself, the tendency is to be lazy and just let it roll in. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Martin or Billy.
Martin?
I haven't really got much of a comment to make about this.
I'm all for more of proactive production, that's what I think.
I think what is, and I don't, you know, you can quote me on this if you wish, I think Radio Bristol is going through a sort of a phase of transition, and they're not sure whether or not they want to be mandated by their audience, or if they're going to start making brave editorial decisions and investing in the producers that they've got up there. The one other final point I think is important to make here is that, strangely, a lot of people have quite modern radios in their cars now. And there's a little function on your car radio where you can hit a button and it tunes in automatically to Radio Bristol or whichever local radio station it is, just to give you the traffic updates. And I think possibly that one tiny piece of software could be the undoing of an awful lot of radio, local radio stations. I, as I mentioned, they cater quite well for sport up there. And the only other thing really, I mean, you can see the weather by looking out the window. The only other service service, I think, that is in much demand is the traffic. And now there's a button that can do it without you having to go through the dirge of listening to an awful lot of it.
Well, I can tell you that the motorways around Bristol right now are pretty much clear, because I've got Traffic England up on the computer here.
Yeah.
And so the motorways are pretty clear. I mean, usually the road from Gloucester down towards Cirencester is pretty busy. That's a bit slow, we can say that. But anyway, if you're on that road, you couldn't pick us up anyway. But no, certainly around Bristol, it's clear.
Yes, but apparently we have a lot of listeners in Bath who intend to listen to Radio 4. So apologies for that if you were hoping to get Eddie Mayer this evening. But as I was mentioning, that there's quite clever car radios in cars now, and they automatically retune. A lot of people coming out of Bath retune to us when they're trying to get Radio 4.
Another final thing on this. I don't know how many people remember the drama series, BBC drama series Shoestring.
Oh, yeah.
From the, I think it was the late 1980s.
Yes, Trevor Eve, down at Radio West.
That's right, they had Radio West. And Radio West was characterised a little bit like we see Radio Bristol being characterised here today in the Evening Post, as something that's a little bit staid, not very adventurous. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we've got a Radio Bristol which is being characterised just as it was set in the own BBC drama, as something which is a little bit too staid.
It's very strange.
Wasn't it Alan Partridge, Radio Norwich?
Yes.
That's your hero, isn't it, Tony?
Well, we've got Alan on the line as well. Alan, I wonder if you want to chip in on this discussion about BBC local radio. Are you,
can I tell you, just for the record, I started my broadcasting career by passing a board at BBC Radio Bristol when it was controlled by a rather good guy called Stuart White. And I was assigned to Southampton, where I began to learn about radio and television broadcasting. So I have, a spiritual tie with Bristol.
Have you got any thoughts about how to make a station really local and lively and adventurous?
Well, I would put two things together. I want to find a way to put new politics, to give a new meaning to politics. And I would like to see local radio stations getting much more out into communities and having real debates and finding out what it is that people really want and what they will accept and what they will not object. It's a small way of helping to give some real life to democracy.
Okay, so anyway, that's our little discussion about Radio Bristol finished with. I don't know if you two in the studio have got any more to add, finally.
Well, I'm waiting for the phone to ring for them to offer me a job.
Okay.
Yes, I do understand Billy's got to be very careful about what he says here.
Well, we do have to be...
He's trying to get his foot in the door, I understand.
And, of course, their broadcast area is much, much wider than ours and in the evenings. And, of course, I think the other thing I was amazed to see that they may be stopping is this programme on a Saturday where they have all this kind of old-time music. I can't remember the name of the presenter. I don't know if you either people in the studio know. But they do have some very, very good stuff on. And it seems that... Tim Pemberton is now thinking about cutting that. I think if people have got any thoughts of it on it, just get a copy of today's Evening Post, and all the contact details for the stations are in there if you want to make your views felt to the boss.
Yes, or if failing that, if you would like to make your views known to us, then please do email studio@bcfm.org.uk. If you feel there's part of the BBC remit that isn't being covered by them, then let us know and we'll see if we can make up for it.
Yes, we want to be slagged off in the Evening Post. Is that fair?
Okay, with that we'll finish our little discussion, but now we're on to looking now a little bit more seriously at the Israel-Palestine conflict with Alan on the phone. And I'm joined, as I said, on the phone by Alan, who is, his name is Alan Hart, H-A-R-T, who is author of the two-volume book Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. Before he wrote the book, he was also a foreign correspondent for ITN and the BBC's Panorama programme. We British were the last colonial power in Israel-Palestine, handing over power to the Israeli Knesset in 1947. So we bear a great deal of responsibility for the mess that's happening there now. So we're going to start, though, with Marina Morris. And she's been out on the streets in the past week asking you what you think of Zionism. Zionism essentially is a sort of nationalistic Jewish movement which led to the creation of the State of Israel.
Theodore Herzl founded the Zionist movement in the 1890s, and, you know, the aspirations towards a Jewish homeland, but of course they didn't have much influence within the Jewish community in that era. I mean, Jews tended to be involved in local politics wherever they happened to live.
But do ordinary people on the street actually know what Zionism is? Now here's Marina Morris with the Vox Pop on Zionism.
What do you think Zionism means? Is it anything to do with, like, Zion as in Mormons' ideal world, idealism, something? Well, Zion was the Mormons' place that they decided that's where God would be and that's the perfect world. So I don't know if it's anything connected to that, but if it's not, then I've no idea.
Don't know.
No.
Yes. It's to do with the Jewish faith. And now another name for the Jewish faith. It's probably to do with Homeland and all that stuff as well.
Nationalist movement for the rebirth of the State of Israel.
Is Middle Eastern politics important to the UK?
It is if it's going to affect us going to war. And on our oil supplies, I think politics all over the world in general should be important to every other country because it's all about the balance.
I think it's very important for our financial status and for everyday people because we need to know how much the oil is going to cost and how much we're going to have to expend out. And we also need to know so we can keep our country's infrastructure secure. So yes, I think it's very important.
I think it's important to all governments, particularly the UK, yes.
As somebody said, God must have a sense of humour to put all that oil under all those Arabs. Yes.
Okay, one of the most interesting comments I thought there is it's important for our financial status understanding the possible future cost of oil. What's your take on Zionism, Alan, if you can go right from the start, from Theodore Herzl? Because one of the things I find most curious about this is that even though Zionism is all about the Jewish right through the Bible to the promised land, Theodore Herzl himself was actually an atheist.
Tony, there is one key to understanding the Middle East and this conflict, and it's knowing, and you must allow me to give the key, it's knowing the difference between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism, briefly summarized, is the religion of Jews, not the Jews, because not all Jews are religious. And like Christianity, and like Islam, Judaism has at its core a set of moral values and ethical principles. That's Judaism. Zionism is a sectarian colonial enterprise which created a state for some Jews in the Arab heartland, mainly by terrorism and ethnic cleansing 700,000 Palestinians from their homeland. And by so doing, Zionism made a complete mockery of the values and the moral principles of Judaism. Judaism and Zionism are total opposites. Now, very briefly, why is it important to know the difference? When you do know it, you can understand two things. Why it is perfectly possible to be anti-Zionist, anti-Zionism's colonial enterprise, without being in any way, shape, or form anti-Semitic, anti-Jew in the classic meaning of the term, but Arabs are also Semites, so if you're really anti-Semitic, you hate both Jews and Arabs. The other thing that you can then understand when you know this difference is why it is wrong to blame all Jews everywhere for the crimes of the hardcore Zionist few in Israel, which is not a Jewish state, it is a Zionist state. And I conclude this by saying, why the title of my book, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews? The sleeping giant of classical anti-Semitism, loathing of Jews, is being reawakened by Israel's behavior. And unless the Western world can be brought to understand the difference between Judaism and Zionism, there will ultimately be another great turning against the Jew.
But surely the Zionists have a right to national aspirations, just like any other national movement.
No, the Zionists claim that they were given their right by a UN partition plan resolution in 1947. What the world doesn't know until it reads my book is it was only a resolution of the General Assembly. The resolution was only got through on the narrowest of majority because the Zionist lobby persuaded four governments to change their minds and vote for the partition plan resolution.
But the narrow majority of the United Nations is a narrow majority, isn't it?
Hang on. The truth is, okay, got the majority. But the truth is, what the General Assembly decides is only a recommendation. Nothing can become UN policy until it goes to the Security Council for approval. This did not go to the Security Council for approval because President Truman knew that if it was approved, given the strength of Arab and Muslim worldwide opposition to it, it could only be imposed by force. And President Truman was not prepared to use force. So the truth is that the partition resolution was vitiated, became invalid. What the Americans then did, they went back to the General Assembly to begin a new debate saying, what the hell can we do about Palestine and Zionism? It was while they were debating that that Israel unilaterally declared itself to be in existence, actually in defiance of the organized international community at the UN, including the Truman administration.
But surely at that point, Britain had pulled out. I mean, we were the colonial power, and we pulled out. I mean, who can blame them for actually forming a government and getting organized?
Well, you say who can blame them. Is it right that they should take the land that did not belong to them and drive out 700,000 Palestinians by ethnic cleansing?
Obviously, it wasn't right. I'd like to also distinguish that there are different shades of Zionism. I mean, you've got Jabotinsky Zionism, which is sort of right-wing, very, very anti-Arab. And, of course, Zionism also had a left-wing face, the Israeli Labour Party, people like Golda Meir and so on, and they got a lot of support and credibility in liberal circles in the West because of the kind of guilt about what had happened in the Holocaust and so on and so forth. And we were speaking earlier about Yitzhak Rabin. He was a Labour politician in terms of Israeli politics. I think that the kind of line you're taking, Alan, could lead to the conclusion that the State of Israel shouldn't be there at all, and I think that's a legitimate point to have.
Well, that's true, but the fact is that it's there. It exists.
It is. I mean, I would compare it to the loyalist population in the six counties. I mean, in many respects, they were like outside settlers brought in to put down the local population.
I couldn't agree with you
But at the same time, you know, that's a long time ago, and they live there now. And to a certain extent, we've got to accept that the Jewish population in Palestine, Israel, is probably there to stay. But then But the question is, how are we going to resolve the needs and values of all the other people that need to?
I mean, I have no argument with the fact that Israel exists. I mean, it has always craved acceptance and recognition of the Palestinians for a very simple reason. The Israelis know full well, or their leaders do, that in international law, the only people who could legitimize the existence of the Zionist state are the Palestinians, nobody else. And that's why they've always demanded. Now, one of the great myths, there are two great myths. One is that poor little Israel has lived in danger of annihilation. That is simply not true. Israel's existence had never, ever been in danger, not in 48, not in 56, not in 67, not even in 1973. The other great myth is Israel has had no partners for peace. That is the most massive historical lie. As far back as their Declaration of Independence, King Abdullah of Jordan was seeking to make peace with them. More important, Egypt's President Nasser, that's in our matter of record, it's documented, it's public, he was seeking an accommodation with Israel. He even had a secret dialogue with Israel's then foreign minister Moshe Sharet, who became briefly prime minister.
But that's peace talks. That's just normal, Alan, surely.
No, but the point is, in Zionism's version of history, upon which the whole of Judeo-Christian history is premised, Israel has never had partners for peace. That's my point. I'm saying that's a lie.
Okay, so We have another clip now, and that is this is from the Dispatches programme that went out on UK's Channel 4, was put together by Peter Oborne. And let's move forward a little bit and look at something called the Israel Lobby. Now, AIPAC in the United States is quite well known about, certainly over there, as a lobbying group for the political parties in the United States. But what's not quite so well known is the Israel Lobby here in Britain. And here's a little clip from that programme which went out late last year.
Tonight on Dispatches, how British policy is influenced by supporters of a foreign power.
Something became skewed in British politics when an unelected friend of the Prime Minister had so much influence.
Dispatches reveals the activities of the most effective lobby working inside British political parties.
The pro-Israeli lobby in this country is the most powerful political lobby. There's nothing to touch them.
We investigate the Israel lobby's bankrolling of British politicians.
I don't believe, and I don't think anybody else would believe, that these contributions come with no strings attached.
The Israeli invasion of Gaza caused huge controversy. A few months later, the Conservative Friends of Israel held its annual lunch for conservative politicians and businessmen. This year, the star speaker was David Cameron. I was astonished to note that he made no reference to the widespread killing of innocent civilians and massive destruction in Gaza 6 months earlier. Indeed, Cameron went out of his way to praise Israel because, so he said, it strives to protect innocent life. He said, if I become Prime Minister, Israel has a friend who will never turn his back on Israel. I resolved to ask questions. How does the pro-Israel lobby in Britain work? Who runs it? And how does it get results? What's clear is that support for Israel is a powerful presence in all the main parties. Look at this recent exchange in the House of Commons when David Amos, Secretary of the Conservative Friends of Israel, asked what the government was doing to improve British relations with Israel. Ivan Lewis, the Foreign Office Minister who had been Deputy Chair of the Labour Friends of Israel, replied.
Israel is a close ally of the UK, and we have regular, warm and productive exchanges at all levels. We shall continue to foster a close relationship with Israel.
Well, that was just a brief extract from the beginning of a Dispatches documentary by Peter Oborne, who usually is a columnist in the Daily Mail, from late last year. Can you tell us, Alan, what your knowledge is of the various of the strength, the power of the Israeli lobby in Westminster?
Well, first of all, there's one correction that has to be made. The flaw with that programme is the same as the flaw in the book by Mershaw Maron Walt on the Israel lobby in America. It's not an Israel lobby. That would imply that it speaks for all Israelis, and it doesn't. It's a Likud lobby, more properly defined as a Zionist lobby. And the man who first put that to me was Shimon Peres. At the time, he was the leader of the opposition to Begin's government, and I was actually the secret link man in an exploratory conversation between Peres and Arafat. And Peres said to me, our problem is that it's not an Israel lobby, it's a Likud lobby. But the lobby system is, you know, it needs its own two or three sentences of explanation. In America, you cannot run for Congress or even the White House without certainly organized Jewish lobby, Zionist lobby funding. And in tight election races, there are six constituencies where the Jewish vote can make or break you. The delivery of the organized Jewish vote. The power of the Zionist lobby, its control over Congress, is enormous. Now, what has happened in Britain, particularly in the last decade or so, is that same money influence has come into British politics. It really is an enormously powerful lobby.
But surely the Arabs, Alan, also have their lobby too.
Look, the Arabs I am, if you like, anti-Zionist in my book. I am passionately anti the Arab regimes and elite. The truth about them is that when Israel succeeded in establishing its state, its fait accompli in 48-49, the Arab regimes shared the same hope as Zionists, as the major Western powers. They wanted the Palestine file to remain closed forever, because they knew that if it was ever reopened, there would at some point have to be a confrontation with Zionism, which ultimately meant a confrontation with the West. The leaderships in the Arab world are incompetent as well as corrupt and repressive, and they have effectively washed their hands of the Palestinians.
Well, obviously, I agree with all of that. I mean, certainly the Labour Party, Lord Levy was Blair's main money man and also very close to the Israeli government. And, of course, what Blair's been trying to do with the Labour Party over the last 10, 15 years is break the financial tie with the trade union movement and to find other sponsors for new Labour policies. And Lord Levy has been a very, very important character in the fundraising for the Labour Party.
Martin, course, you're absolutely right, but he was actually very clever. You're right. Tony Blair came in wanting to break the money hold that the trade unions had on the Labour Party, so he did turn to Lord Levy. And Lord Levy raised the first 80 or 90 million for Blair. But then Levy said to himself, oh, I must be a bit cleverer than this. And then he found half a dozen Muslim wealthy stooges,
yep,
who in return for promises of knighthoods and a place in the House of Lords would donate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, this raises the question of money in politics to court. You know, I mean, it's not just Israeli money that's poisoning politics. It's the wellspring of a lot of the corruption in our political system in Britain and elsewhere, wherever the money comes from.
Do you
solve this problem?
Do you think that's why many of the European countries they do state funding of political parties?
Well, that's,
no, I mean, I personally would like to see state funding of political parties and nothing else. That would restrict the budget, you know, 20 million for each election or whatever. But what it would mean is that they would not be able to have all these rich advertisements on television and radio and newspapers. They'd have to do what politicians did when I was a kid and a teenager. They'd have to come out to the sticks and addresses.
Yeah, I mean, in Scandinavian countries, it's been standard practice since World War II that all political parties are funded by the state, and that reduces the amount of money involved and levels the playing field. But if the British public have been brainwashed into the idea that, oh, we're not paying for politicians, but if you don't pay for politicians, somebody else will, and the who pays the piper calls the tune.
Back in April last year, that's April 2009, it was the 60th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. And President Obama made a speech all about it. And we have this is about 2 minutes of that speech now.
This is a time for Israelis, for Jews, and for all friends of Israel to celebrate the realization of a dream and to rededicate ourselves to uplifting the promise of Israel's independence. You know, a few years ago, in the winter of 2006, I had the great privilege of traveling to the Holy Land. And as all of you know, it's a place unlike any on earth, a place filled with history, a place filled with promise, a place that's known moments of terrible darkness, but also extraordinary joy. One of the most joyful moments came 60 years ago this week, when the Jewish State of Israel declared independence. While that day marked a new beginning, it also concluded a journey unlike any in the history of the world. It's a journey that dates back to Moses leading his people towards the promised land, a journey that included centuries of hope for the Jewish people when their dream of a homeland was darkest, a journey that gained new meaning through the work of Zionist leaders like Theodor Herzl, and a new urgency after the terrible suffering and loss of the Holocaust. And it was a dream no longer deferred when David Ben-Gurion declared Israel's independence 60 years ago this week. The end of this journey was not the end of the challenges facing Israel. The fight for independence and the fight for the survival of a Jewish state has endured through decades of war and of terror. To this very day, the people of Israel show their uncommon courage and commitment to freedom every time they board a bus or kiss their children goodbye. But through these challenges to their state's existence, Israelis have done more than survive. They have forged a brilliant and strong democracy. They've provided a promised land for Jews from around the world. They've built a thriving economy that has spread opportunity to Israeli citizens while enriching the world. And they've developed a rich cultural life and made enormous contributions to the sciences and the arts. Israel's also developed many friendships, and none is deeper than the bond between the people of Israel and the people of the United States. It's a bond rooted in the millions of Jewish immigrants. It's a bond rooted in the millions of Jewish immigrants who sought opportunity on America's shores, in the liberation of those awful Nazi death camps in World War II, and in the courageous stance of an American president 60 years ago this week. It was not a foregone conclusion that Harry Truman would recognize Israel. Senior members of his own government counseled him not to, and many other countries would be slow in embracing the young Jewish state. But Truman stood on principle. He recognized that America shared fundamental values with this new democracy and that Israel's independence was hard-earned. He would later write that he believed a solemn promise had been made to an oppressed people, and he refused to stand in the way of the hopes and the dreams of the Jewish people. And so minutes after David Ben-Gurion made his announcement, President Truman made the United States the first nation to recognize Israel, and our abiding friendship was born.
So that was Barack Obama speaking in the middle of last year on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of Israel. He mentioned this David Ben-Gurion, Alan. Can you tell us who David Ben-Gurion actually was?
Yeah. David Ben-Gurion was an immigrant from Poland, and he was the founding father of Israel. But we haven't got much time left, so I want to say this. There's a reality in America that has to be acknowledged by anybody who's interested in peace. No American president is ever going to be free to apply the necessary pressure for Israel to be serious about peace because of the Zionist lobby's stranglehold on Congress, unless and until there is a constituency of understanding in the people of America. Only that is going to create the space for an American president to take on the Zionist lobby in Congress. And at the moment, there's no sign of that happening. There are two views of Obama. One is that he is a well-managed instrument of Zionism. I'm not sure I buy that. I think more to the point is that he's a great speaker, inspirational even, but he's very inexperienced, and I think when he went into the White House, he truly had no idea of the real power of the Zionist lobby as it relates to American policy making for the Middle East.
Well, we've got just only 5 minutes left. Let's spend that looking at the prospects for peace. Martin, let's come to you. What are your thoughts about some of the more potentially successful avenues for actually getting real peace? Because one of the things I can remember hearing about since I was this big, a child, is that there is a peace process in the Middle East, but this peace process never seems to really lead anywhere.
Well, it's not going to lead anywhere as long as the Israelis aren't under sufficient pressure from the US to deliver what's required, as Alan has pointed out. I think we do need an education program to get people to understand that the Israelis are not necessarily in the right just because they say they are. But if we're going to have a war on terror and send our troops to Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, wherever it is we're going to send them, that's a whole other big issue. We really can't afford to have the Israelis making mess in the Middle East and undermining British troops as they're being put on the ground in Muslim countries.
So you're saying it's just Western pressure? That's the only thing?
When Obama mentioned in his little speech there how economically successful Israel had been, Israel is a great big welfare case. Every citizen of Israel is in receipt of thousands of dollars of taxpayer subsidy every year from the United States of America. If that subsidy was withdrawn, or even threats were made to withdraw it, I saw that George Mitchell suggested that loans might not be rolled over, and immediately the Israeli press went bonkers. But of course, the US government could cut off Israel's money supply just like that, and then they might be more reasonable.
Alan, let's leave the final word to you. What are your thoughts about the most successful potential avenue to peace?
I don't see one at the moment. And I think the real problem is this, and it's the truth about why Israel possesses nuclear weapons. And I had this conversation privately, I have to say, at the time with Moshe Dayan, who was a one-eyed warlord, years ago. I said to him, Moshe, you don't need nuclear weapons vis-a-vis the Arabs. You can beat them any day of the week you like with both hands tied behind your back. Why have you got them? And he said more or less the following. Ben-Gurion was not stupid. I'm not stupid. We know how the real world of politics works. We know that the day will come when even our best friends, he meant America, will say to us, thank you, Israel, you've served your purpose. You're now more of a liability than not. You must do this. And we shall say, Mr. President, don't push us further than we are prepared to go, because we could use these things. And on page 3 of my book, I quote Golda Meir when she was Prime Minister in a conversation I did with her, Panorama. And at a point, I said to her, excuse me, Prime Minister, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You are saying that if ever Israel was in danger of being defeated, you would be prepared to take the region and the whole world down with you. Without a pause, Golda said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. That program went out at 8 o'clock on a Monday evening. By 10 o'clock, the Times of London had changed its lead editorial, quoted what Golda had said to me, and added its own opinion, we had better believe her.
Well, Alan, thank you ever so much for joining us this evening. That's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain, and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. This week's guest, Alan Hart, is author of Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews. And also he has a blog on the internet, so you can just look that up at alanhart.net. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Alan Hart, our resident Old Labour pundit too, Martin Summers, and to Marina Morris for this week's Vox Pop on Zionism. Next week at 5, we'll be doing it all again, and helping us dissect the week's news will be the Labour leader on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Up next is Somali language programming with Nemo and Somali Youth. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing weekend.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.